When they tell us they need new clients, we slow them down to look at the list of existing clients. There are so many more ways those already existing people could be served. Our clients are pressed for cash flow because they allow their brains to spend 90% of the time fretting about the future. One client was a professional speaker and sales trainer we will call Jill. Jill wanted coaching on how to increase her income dramatically, so we began by looking at her calendar. We knew by listening to Jill talk that her brain was wrung out at the end of each day because she worried. When a person uses her brain for worrying, it's a misuse. It's an abuse of the brain. It would be like using your computer as a doorstop. Jill showed me her calendar and I said, "Let's slow your rapid life down for a moment. Tell me what this is here. You've written the words bank keynote." "Oh, that's a keynote speech I'm giving. It's okay. $6,000. I need more of those. 3 of those a month and I'll be where I want to be. I guess I need to send my DVD and brochure to more banks." Slow down. Slow down? Why do they want a keynote? "I don't know. The bank is having a sales retreat. I guess sales are down in this territory. They always have keynote speeches at these things." I suggested that Jill had more business than she realized, but because her mind was always racing ahead wherever she was, it was probably racing ahead when she talked to the top person at the bank about this keynote. I asked her to go back in and find out why they wanted the keynote, what they hoped it would accomplish, why they were having their event, what they hoped the retreat would accomplish, and 20 more questions. A week later, Jill came back rather stunned. The bank manager told her all kinds of objectives they had for the event and revealed a long list of problems their team was facing. Some of those problems, like telephone sales skills, community relations, and referral acquisition, were subjects that Jill was experienced in teaching. She came out of that meeting with enough information about the bank's immediate needs to write a proposal for a year's training program. 2 months later, they approved it, and Jill had a contract for more than 15 times the amount she got for the keynote. All because she slowed down, stayed in the moment, and took her time. After a year of coaching, Jill finally saw that everything she ever wanted was always right in front of her. She's been going too fast through life to see it, always trying to get into her own future like a cat chasing its own shadow. The present moment is paved with gold, just like the streets of heaven. It's only the future that's bleak and frightening. Stay out of it. Number 10. Don't be a wealth wannabe. Henry Ford said, quote, "Wealth, like happiness, is never attained when sought after directly. It comes as a byproduct of providing a useful service." End quote. One of the fastest ways to go broke is to try to get rich quick. One of the biggest enemies of true wealth creation is getting sucked into the latest money-making scheme, or real estate trend, or hot new thing. Don't let yourself get hooked into the idea that you're going to stumble into the one magic key that's going to lead to easy money. And there are a lot of those schemes floating around. Surf through all the infomercials on TV and you'll find them. But all of these wealth wannabe schemes are self-defeating because they give you the false hope that you can find some source outside yourself and create prosperity with ease overnight. We are not saying you can't make money easily and quickly. You can. But be very wary of an appeal that says, "Just get in now and we'll do all the work for you." Be wary of thinking you might get lucky this way. Luck is not something you want to associate with wealth. luck and true enduring wealth have no relationship to each other whatsoever. You will see infomercials every day on TV selling you the hot new opportunity, but what they are really selling you is your own gullibility. They're handing it back to you on a silver platter. So when you see TV ads offering you franchises or machines that will make you money, you can be sure that what they are selling you is your own yearning for a quick fix. And we all know the illegal pyramid schemes that have been going on forever. One person talks to you about how they've made $50,000 already, and if you get in soon enough and sign enough other people up quickly, you'll make a fortune. Just don't break the chain. But the math will catch up to you if the law doesn't, because no one is being served. Service is the way to wealth, not shrewd schemes. Look at the enormous popularity of gambling. Gambling is playing on people's wealth wannabe sickness, the get-rich-quick dream that says, maybe I can get rich without doing any work. The casinos know that the math will catch up with you there, too. No one is being served. All these wealth wannabe schemes also have the fatal flaw of taking you out of the equation. If you want to create real wealth in your life, you must honor yourself as part of the equation. You must build your personal wealth-producing strengths, consciously and proactively. No luck is involved because no luck is necessary. No hot new thing need apply. Putting the focus on the hot thing instead of yourself stops you from asking yourself, what am I good at? What do I love doing? What do I have to offer the world? How can my talents help people? How can I serve? Like the great sales teacher Zig Ziglar always says, you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want. When you read true success stories, like Dave Thomas of Wendy's, or Ray Kroc of McDonald's, or the Home Depot owners, or even Bill Gates at Microsoft, there was never really a hot money-making scheme involved up front. For the first few years, there was a lot of failure and tough work, but it was their inner personal vision that always paid off. That and a desire to serve the most people they could in the best possible way. Serving others by doing what you love to do is your way to wealth. Don't let anyone lure you away from it. Number 11. Stop right where you are. Here's a quote from the Steve Miller Band. Quote, pack my bags, going to Mexico. End quote. Sam used to think when he was younger and trying to go out and conquer the world and make money that he would have to travel to a more opportune place. I was going to go to Mexico, he said, because that was supposed to be the one place that was hot and happening. Then sometime after that, I thought I'd have to get myself to China somehow, because Amway was going to open in China, and I thought, 1 billion Chinese in my multi-level pyramid. Then at one time, I was going to go to New Zealand. There was a long-distance phone service opening there that looked good, so I thought, I have to go over there. That's where the money's going to be. And then I even looked into going to Chile, because I thought that that was going to be where it was happening. Sam now admits he was insane. But it's not uncommon to be insane about where the money is. We all have that lingering thought that the opportunity might be a little greener on the other side of the hill. And there's that great book called Acres of Diamonds by Russell Conwell that dramatically addresses this very insanity. His little book, which you can and should read in less than an hour's sitting, originated as a speech, which Conwell delivered over 6,000 times around the world. Just one speech, over and over, always making a huge impact on the minds of his audiences. Conwell's central idea is that one need not look elsewhere for opportunity, achievement, or fortune. The resources to achieve all good things are present in your own community. His speech was inspired by a true story once told to Conwell by an Arab guide about a man who wanted to find diamonds so badly that he sold his property and went off in a futile search for them. Then the man he sold his property to discovered that a rich diamond mine was located right there underground, right on the property. Conwell elaborated on the theme through examples of success, genius, service, and other virtues involving ordinary Americans contemporary to his audience. "Dig in your own backyard," he would yell out at the end. You can find the text of this inspiring speech online. He used the wealth from that one speech to eventually found and fund Temple University in Philadelphia. When Sam stopped looking around at all these opportunities and far-off lands and simply opened a little music and dance studio right where he was, he found his own acres of diamonds. Today, he knows many people who have left his community to pursue an opportunity elsewhere. And the new area they're in? What a surprise that it wasn't the gold mine that they thought it would be. When we consult with people in less populated areas like Montana or Wyoming or Iowa, they'll often say, "If I were in a state like California, then my business would do really well, because in California they have so many advantages, and the population, the people there have so much money, it would be terrific." Then there was Teresa in California, who was saying to us, if she were in a state like Connecticut, where it was smaller and not as busy and not as expensive to do business, then she'd finally be successful. Because, you know, being in California is harder because it's so populated by others wanting to succeed. We're not saying don't ever move, but don't think you have to either. There's opportunity right where you are. Even more so than before, because we're in such an interconnected global community now. With the internet, it really doesn't matter where you are. The last website you went to buy something, where was it? New York? Idaho? Who cares? We buy books and CDs from Amazon, right? Maybe even this one. And where is Amazon? Who knows? You're at the center of the world, wherever you are. So, be somewhere you really want to be, because you're going to do a better business that way. If you really want to be close to your family, or back in a town that you enjoy and feel like you belong in, then you'll be a part of the community. Don't just be somewhere because you imagine that the business opportunities are better there. Start in a place where you love living and you love being. For some, that's a busy metropolis with lots of energy, and for others, it's not. Get your lifestyle in alignment with your successful career. Have it all work for you. Don't say, someday when we're successful, we can live where we really want to. Start wherever you want. Number 12. Boycott Charles Dickens. Here's a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "Money, which represents the prose of life, and which is hardly spoken of in parlors without an apology, is, in its effects and laws, as beautiful as roses." End quote. The miserly villains in Charles Dickens' novels grab for money at the expense of poor human beings. The Dickens novels may have set the tone for the whole Western culture's view of rich people. Even today, it carries forward. In the movies, it's the evil villain that's the rich guy, and it's always the big moneyed corporation that's out to victimize the little guy. Dickens started that trend. But to attract wealth and be peaceful inside, you have to set your copy of Dickens down and write your own book. The great poet John Milton said, quote, The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell or a hell of heaven. End quote. First of all, money is a good thing. You can help people if you have money. Some problems can only be solved with money. All the wonderful foundations that save the environment, protect animals, help educate poor people, and cure diseases are not funded by poor people. And the whole Charles Dickens mindset that people with money are the oppressors has a lot of sour grapes in it. Instead of, "That could be me," people are thinking, "I wouldn't want to be like rich people are." And soon, there's a negative mythology around rich people. The irony is that the people who are the most persistent in perpetuating the stereotype are the very Hollywood actors and directors who are making $20 million a film. They grow rich starring in the movie that tries to portray rich people as being evil for accepting so much money for what they do. It's no wonder that people get so confused about this subject, and it does not help your own prosperity to blindly accept the Charles Dickens stereotype, because you're not going to want to become something that is despised by even you. With your children, it's especially important to eliminate the stereotype. You want to make sure that your kids don't think that rich people are automatically bad people. Parents pass down their own bitter, jealous feelings about people with money. They often use their nastiest voices to say things like, "Oh, those people, oh yeah, they're really rich." And the child can hear the contempt in the voice. Was it envy, or rage, or bitterness, or fear that made money evil? Spiritual teacher Byron Katie has freed many people from their money issues and helped them to fully enjoy watching the ebb and flow of wealth without worrying about any of it. As Katie has said, quote, "Money is a wonderful metaphor. It flows from here to there, through all countries, through phone systems and wires. It shows us how to be mentally, how to flow, how not to have any barriers, how to take all forms. It shows us how easy it is to come in and leave all the time. It's a great guru. If you did what money does, you would be completely in love with what is." End quote. Society offers your brain a wealth vocabulary and a poverty vocabulary. Whichever one you choose to think and speak with will have a major influence on your success, because you can actually end up sentencing yourself to wealth or poverty with the sentences you form in your mind and in your chosen conversations. When you speak, every cell in your body listens in. Your subconscious mind files your words away as reality, and you can test that language-to-reality process out for yourself at any time. Just repeat certain words and phrases such as, "I'm getting really sleepy, I'm getting really sleepy," and feel what happens. You'll start to yawn, you'll actually start to get sleepy. You might try saying, "I can taste lemons in my mouth," and all of a sudden your mouth will pucker up and you'll feel the sour taste. These experiments will show you that whatever it is you're thinking and speaking has a tremendous impact on all the chemistry in your system, whether you think you believe it completely or not. So, it's a great wealth-encouraging practice to reverse yourself when you catch yourself using the language of the poor. Catch yourself before you say, "Oh, we'll never afford that." And then say, "Well, wait a minute. That's not really true. There's a good chance we could afford it soon. I'm really good at what I do." You can always revise what you've just said. Let your words pay tribute to your ability to create wealth through your own thinking. As Napoleon Hill taught us, we really can think and grow rich. and that was his whole point. It doesn't take a genius to get rich. The average person can think and grow rich. Language isn't just some superficial communication form. It is the mental process that creates our unique world. We speak our world into existence. To do anything, you first have to think it. And then when you say it, that reinforces it further. And soon you're actually doing it. But in the beginning, there was the word. If you sentence yourself to an early disconnect by not being able to even think the things you will do, it's going to be hard, if not impossible, to actually do them. Everyone who's experienced hypnotherapy and hypnotism knows that if you can get language into the brain that says it's not possible to raise your arm, you really can't raise your arm. A skilled hypnotherapist can bypass the left side of the brain and go directly to the right brain, saying, "Your eyelids are heavy," or "Your legs are cold, and they cannot move, and you will not be able to get up from this chair." And it really happens that you can't. So whatever you tell yourself is possible will literally become what is possible. Stop talking about the bad economy or how I just can't win. Don't talk about the little guy always gets shortchanged. Don't say, "It's who you know." That's all poverty language. Our habitual words about wealth and success also become frozen into attitudes. So as a test, over the next couple days, listen to what people say and how they speak about certain things. Ask people what they think of the internet and notice how they respond. Or ask people what they think of the economy or the community they live in and notice how they respond. That'll tell you a lot about whether someone's speaking the language of the poor. It will also explain a lot about their position in life. Or, as Napoleon Hill put it, quote, "Our brains become magnetized with the dominating thoughts which we hold in our minds, and, by means with which no one is familiar, these magnets attract to us the forces, the people, the circumstances of life, which harmonize with the nature of our dominating thoughts," end quote. From now on, you can start challenging the truth of all poverty thoughts. You can replace them with magnetic, wealth-inspiring thoughts. Instead of, "I have to do this," you'll say, "I'm choosing to do this." Instead of problems, you'll now work with games, projects, and fascinatingly challenging situations. You'll replace, "I'm trying to get through this," with, "There's a lot I can get from it." The language of victimization and obligation, "I should," will be replaced with the language of intention, "I want to," "I choose to," "I will." Will I succeed at creating wealth in my life? I want to, I choose to, and I will. Number 13. Turn boring business into art. Andy Warhol had a quote. He said, "I like boring things," end quote. 20 years ago, if you told someone that two of the greatest performing businesses in recent history would be a hardware store and a coffee shop, they'd think you were on some kind of drug. But Home Depot and Starbucks took boring businesses and made them exciting. 20 years ago, no one thought a hardware store could be that exciting. However, Home Depot did something to make it exciting. They rejuvenated the whole idea of how fun it is to do the work yourself. Just because hardware was an industry that existed for a long time didn't mean it wasn't a huge opportunity for wealth. When it comes to wealth creation, people always think that they have to pick something exciting, like the conversation you hear at cocktail parties. "I'm into what's happening now. Genetic nano-information. I got in just in time." "Wow, you're in that? That must be great." But boring industries have some advantages over the hot-sounding futuristic industries. First of all, if something is a boring industry, it has probably existed for a while, so it has an established market, and people already use the product or service, so you won't have to wait for it to catch on. You don't have to project where it will be 10 years from now. A boring established industry is something that's been around for 30 years, and there's a great chance that it'll also be around 30 more years from now. When Sam and his wife Val started their studio business, the commonplace nature of it helped create wealth for them. It was a so-called boring business, teaching kids music and dance lessons, not a hot, new, glamorous-sounding business on the surface at all. That service and that business had existed for 1,000 years, just teaching people how to play an instrument and how to dance. But their dedication and innovation made it exciting and turned Sam into a millionaire. Wayne Wizinga has owned the Miami Dolphins, the Florida Marlins, Blockbuster, and many companies that have made him millions. But he started in garbage collection and built from there. The other secret here is that there really are no boring industries. They're only boring when you put them to the cocktail party test. But once you get inside them, it's amazing how fun and fascinating you can make them. Look at what Andy Warhol did with the soup can. Because he was at times bedridden and sickly as a child, Andy Warhol became an outcast among his schoolmates. As he lay in bed, he used to draw, listen to the radio, and collect pictures of movie stars that he put on the bedroom wall. Looking back later, Warhol described that period of his childhood as influential in the development of his intriguing, reclusive personality and in the forming of his artistic interests. Wealth can start anywhere when the mind stays open. It was during the 1960s that Warhol transformed himself from an advertising illustrator into one of the most famous American artists who ever lived. Andy Warhol helped define the decade of modern pop art. He took the boring out of boring and made it fascinating. Warhol began to make paintings of famous but dull American products, such as Campbell's soup cans. He soon switched to silk screen prints that he produced serially, seeking not only to make art of mass-produced items, but to mass-produce art itself. Warhol said he wanted to be a machine. He minimized the role of his own creative insight in the production of his work, and thereby sparked a revolution in art. His work quickly became very controversial and popular. Soon there were Warhol dollar bills, celebrities, brand name products, and images from newspaper clippings. He used material that was already there in front of everyone. Nothing new, such as plain, old, boring Coca-Cola bottles. Warhol said, quote, "What's great about this country is that America started the tradition where the richest consumers buy essentially the same things as the poorest. You can be watching TV and see Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coke, Liz Taylor drinks Coke, and just think, you can drink Coke too. A Coke is a Coke, and no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one the bum on the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Liz Taylor knows it, the president knows it, the bum knows it, and you know it." End quote. Warhol later founded Interview Magazine and published The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, in which he declared, "Making money is art, and working is art, and good business is the best art." Warhol had so many possessions, it took Sotheby's 9 days to auction his estate after his death for a total gross amount of over $20 million. His total estate was worth considerably more. He was one of the greatest pop artists who ever lived, and successful because he loved what to other people was boring. So half the fun of work is what you bring to it. whether you can transform it from a mere job to a work of art, making each day your masterpiece. Number 14. Switch from need to want. Jules Renard said, quote, "Everything you want is out there waiting for you to ask. Everything you want also wants you, and you have to take action to get it." End quote. I really need this job. I need this money. So I have to go along. I have to sell myself. I have to turn away opportunities because I have to. I can't afford to say no to this. Familiar? It's the incessant internal dialogue of need. All the things I need to do. All the things I absolutely have to do. We were coaching a business a year ago that had a problem employee we will call Willie, who is also a top money producer and a salesperson. The small business owner, Aaron, kept saying, "Willie is just bad for my business, taking up a whole lot of my mental energy. On the other hand, he's a profitable person to keep. He's a big producer, so we need Willie. We can't just let him go. It's going to cost the business all this money if we do. And we really can't afford to do that." Aaron thought he needed Willie. And as in all professional relations, need is toxic. It is psychologically dysfunctional, and it never ends well, not in our experience. Finally, the owner, Aaron, made the decision just to say, "No, we're not going to operate from a position of need. We're going to start operating from a position of want, living in the inquiry, what do we really want this company to be?" He made that tough decision to let Willie go at a very inopportune time. And it did cost Aaron a fair amount of cash flow short term. However, looking back later, he was happy because the action he took broke through the whole psychological barrier of need. After that, Aaron never let his needs govern his actions. He ran his business based on his wants. Not only that, but the new person who filled Willie's place had the production back to Willie's level in less than 3 months. Your whole mind goes weak whenever you think in terms of need, and a weak mind does not create. A lot of the small companies we work with have their whole business set up based on trying to continuously fill their needs. So they have meetings based on, what do we need to do? What positions do we need to fill? After these fear-based meetings, anxious employees scatter anxiously throughout the building, trying to fill all the unmet needs. These meetings are poisoned with the word need. What kind of inventory do we need to stock given the urgent jobs we have coming up? It's all a fearful reaction to life. It's completely reaction-based rather than creation-based, and the whole purpose of our coaching and consulting is to help people create wealth instead of just filling needs. Success is a creation. It's not an unfulfilled need. When we can get an individual or a small company to switch their conversation from needs to wants, they surge ahead. We switch from what do we need to do to what's our desire. The more people are willing to put words and pictures to their ideal scene, the faster it becomes a reality. Without it, your mind can't serve you. The mind does not solve general problems or achieve vaguer general goals. An ideal scene is full of color and precision, like a Chinese painting. Enlightened wealth creators start their meetings this way. What do we want to create? What do we want to produce? All of a sudden, everything changes, and they get out ahead of the curve, and they start anticipating opportunities. Now they are profitable. Need takes your energy away. Ayn Rand said it, it's the quote in the front of this book, best, that America was the first country to ever use the phrase, make money. Everyone else always referred to money in some other subservient, obsequious way, like it comes to you, you get lucky, you're blessed by it, or some kind of humble, victimized relationship to receiving it from on high. America was the first country to ever step up and say, we're simply going to make some money, which inserted that one little psychological strength that made America really get it. You can produce wealth. You can create financial well-being. It was no accident that America soon led the world in the production of goods. Other nations were thinking that you had to redistribute a finite amount of money. All the socialist countries of the world were trying to redistribute the limited amount of money that was already in existence, whereas America just started creating money out of innovative products and service. Money was generated by imagination in ever-increasing multiples, allowing the human ingenuity to expand outward like the universe itself after the Big Bang. Switching from need to want is a version of that same Big Bang. You can explode your whole culture by this switch. For example, you can ask, how do we want our team meetings to go? Instead of, what do we need to cover? Do we want to call a meeting based on identifying our needs and problems? Or do we want to get out ahead of the curve and ask, what do we want to produce and create in the next week? And how can we do that? The more you think in terms of needs, the needier you get. You lose your sense of inner peace and strength. Now it's all worry all the time, like a 24-hour radio station between your ears. All worry all the time. You are fearful that you're not going to get what you need. Your inner broadcast is, I need a new person. I need customers. I need money. I need a loan. I need a break. You are unnecessarily stressed out because you've created a frantic life of running around to get your needs met. There's no creation in that. There's no invention. There's no loving service of others. None of the things that create wealth happen when you're trying to fulfill unmet needs. Once you shift your mind over to the category of wants, you start getting creative. You're then more in charge. You're doing something you want. When I say, I want more clients than I have, it becomes a want rather than a need, and it very subtly shifts my whole life. There's yet another downside in thinking and living in reaction to perceived needs. It's the shutting down that happens to your energy when a perceived need is no longer present. Need fulfillment behaves just like an addiction. Without a need, you don't take any action. Instead, you think, I don't really need that, so I shouldn't write it down as something that I'm going to acquire or accomplish. I don't really need it. And now, you're not going for it because you don't, quote, need it. When you ask yourself what you want, you can be unlimited in that thinking. You're not limited to the grim world of needs and basic survival. If you just sat down and asked yourself at the start of the day, what do I need? That will produce a very limited list and a very limited life. Most people fall into this needs addiction because they always equate money with survival. I need to pay the mortgage payment this month or else I won't be in the house. I need a roof over my head or I'll die in the winter. So that's what I'm up to today, avoiding my own painful death. Why is this not fun? When you change it to, what do I really want? You might see that what you really want is to have no mortgage payment ever again. You might want the house to be completely paid off so you don't worry about mortgage every month. And because you're willing to identify it as a want, you might even think of a creative way to do that. Take some time to notice the difference between needs and wants in your life. you'll start to see the power in switching. For example, sometimes you'll do something nice for someone, give them a present, or send them a book or CD just because you like them. And their first response will be, "You didn't need to do that." And you can say, "Oh, I wanted to." And that brightens up everything. You can practice this. You can sit down with a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle. You can write your needs down on the left side of the paper. Be honest. How many are there really right now? When you do this exercise, you'll soon find yourself crossing off many items you used to think were needs. Now, on the right side, put down your wants and start to plan your activities based on your wants. It's amazing how many of those wants will come into reality because you've put them down there on paper. You've made them real for yourself, and you've allowed yourself to think about how to bring them into your life. Number 15. Don't invent, reinvent. Jim Rohn said, quote, "Success is doing ordinary things extraordinarily well," end quote. People are always looking to invent a whiz-bang, totally original thing that the world has never seen before. And that's going to make them rich. But most of the wealth that's been created in the world comes from reinvention of an existing service or product. When the Japanese made the jump from being a war-torn nation to being a real industrial power, it was by reinventing things that were already invented. All they did was improve on products that were already out there in the marketplace. They didn't have to invent the automobile. Creativity itself is more reinvention than invention. It's the art of combining existing elements. Most people think creativity is the magical production of something out of nothing. It's not. Mozart said, "I never wrote an original melody in my life." He recombined old folk melodies that he heard in his youth, and that's where he came up with his music. When I started out as a public speaker some 15 years ago, I tried to be just a motivational speaker like everyone else. I thought of Tom Hopkins, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn, Tony Robbins when I took the stage. I was okay. But my business was just not really taking off. I also had a love of acting and stand-up comedy, too, which I thought of as totally separate and unrelated fields. But one day, I decided on the spot to combine all three fields into one chaotic performance. I brought alarming stories of my own failures in life into the motivational speeches in a funny way that caught audiences by surprise. I no longer stayed inside a safe paradigm called motivational speaker. I replaced it with something wilder, more personally risky. I recombined and reinvented the job. Soon I was combining the elements of stand-up comedy with elements of strong motivation and pathetic, personally confessional monologues. All of a sudden, people were saying, "That guy's a true original. We've got to hire that guy again. Nobody's like him." I loved it that people thought I was the ultimate original, but I was actually combining Sam Kinison, Leo Biscaglia, Louis Anderson, Tom Peters, Spalding Gray. Rather than being truly original, I just combined a number of elements that hadn't been in this field before. When Sam started his music and dance studios, he would walk through the competition sites just to get a feel for what he was up against. In these competing studios, he saw clearly that those people did not care. The furniture was rough and tattered, the carpets needed to be replaced, and in one, even the sign was broken outside. They just didn't care. So Sam knew that he didn't have to invent a new way to run a studio. All he had to do was reinvent the original idea, but this time with obsessive caring for the customer. I walked into an auto parts store the other day, and even though there were four guys there behind the counter, not one guy even looked up at me, and the store was empty. I had to clear my throat and make a little fuss of myself just to get noticed. It was like walking into San Quentin, not that I know what that's like. Those people behind the counter were in a prison. They were locked down in their minds. Their brains held them inside a depressed, pessimistic view of the world of work. It wouldn't take much to take all their business away. You wouldn't have to invent anything. You just have to inject some caring into the matrix. Like the old Chinese proverb says, a man without a smile should not open a shop. You can do this with anything. Creativity is about energetic recombinations. It's not about wondering if you're a true original. It's better to be a genuine fake than a true original. Even if you were to open up a steakhouse across the street from a steakhouse, all you'd have to do is be better than they are at everything. And all of a sudden, they'd have no business, and you'd have all the business. So reinventing is just having the enthusiasm to do an extraordinary job, which is lacking in so many careers and businesses right now. That alone will set you apart. How many businesses do you walk into every day where there is no evidence anywhere that anyone wants to do a good job? We experience that every day. So, to reinvent a service offered to the public, all you have to do is really be conscious of what other people aren't doing. Number 16. Learn from the richest guy in the Bible. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, quote, "Great men are they who see that spiritual is stronger than any material force, that thoughts rule the world." End quote. The richest guy in the Bible was King Solomon. In the ancient scriptures, God visits the newly crowned Solomon in a dream and offers him anything he pleases. Solomon asks for an understanding heart. Pleased with his non-greedy wish, God tells Solomon that not only will he receive greater intellect and wisdom than any other man who will ever live, but also great wealth, quote, "which thou hast not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall be not any among the kings like unto thee all thy days," end quote. The lesson was that it's the wisdom, not the money, that is rewarded. It's the understanding heart that leads to wealth, not the other way around. Most people want money so that they can finally have inner peace in their hearts. Their hearts are troubled by all things related to money. They argue with their loved ones about money. Money makes them crazy with anxiety. They haven't learned the ancient lesson from the story of Solomon. Wisdom first, money second. An understanding heart receives more wealth than a worried mind. When you imagine creating wealth, you may imagine that money is the best thing you get from your efforts, but it's not so. It's really the knowledge and the wisdom that you acquire along the way. Sam says, "If I had to choose between giving up all my possessions or giving up the knowledge I've acquired up to this point, I would keep the knowledge. It's far more valuable." You can always recreate what you have materially. When Japan and Germany were reduced to rubble in World War II, they recreated everything and became world economic powers. Study wealthy people over time who have made fortunes and lost fortunes and made the fortunes back, and you start to realize that the knowledge is the real asset. People who exceed their financial goals consistently say that reaching the goal wasn't the payoff, it was who they became along the way. It's never what you get, it's who you become. The same will be true with you. As you highlight the ideas here that click with you and apply them to your own opportunities in life, you will create wealth. And we are basing that prediction on the fact that our individual coaching clients, who now number in the hundreds and who come from all walks of life and temporary failure use these very thinking tools to create wealth for themselves. And yet, in the end, it's not the wealth they love most. It's the knowledge and wisdom they have acquired. It's the ability they now have. So, even if a catastrophe wiped their material wealth out and they had to start over, they know they could do it and would do it. Number 17. Read your fan mail. Nathaniel Brandon said, quote, "The higher your self-esteem, the more likely it is that you will be innovative rather than ritualistic and tradition-bound in your work. This ensures greater success in a world of increasingly rapid change." End quote. One of the deadliest wealth killers is lack of self-esteem. The low self-esteem way to start the day is, "I'm not worth it. Who would ever want to hire me? Why would they want to promote me? Should I even apply for that leadership position?" This lack of self-esteem offers no traction at all. When you lose confidence in the value of what you have to offer, it gets harder and harder to ask for it, because people ultimately pay you not what they think you're worth, but what you think you're worth. Exchanging money is always an exchange of energy. Sometimes it's just the energy of thought, but it's still energy. And it's hard to bring that energy up from a place of low self-worth. So, one of the best ways to keep your confidence and your sense of value high is to read your fan mail. Anytime you get an email complimenting your work, save it. Save it to a certain file. Save all of the rave reviews for anything you do to a certain file. Keep a little journal or notebook. If somebody calls and thanks you or compliments you, jot it down. Because there's going to be a time in your week or next month, where, before you go to a very important meeting, you're going to want to read through those notes and really get who you are. We let our self-esteem slip by not paying attention to it. And sometimes it takes another person to come in and boost us and remind us how good we are. Sometimes our partner or our spouse plays that role and pumps us up before we have a big important conversation, but don't rely on it. Better to be in charge of that function yourself. After all, it is called self-esteem. Number 18. Stop mowing your lawn. Malcolm Forbes said, quote, "If you don't know what to do with many of the papers on your desk, stick a dozen colleagues' initials on them and pass them along. When in doubt, route." End quote. Get someone else to mow your lawn. Get someone else to buy your paper clips. Get someone else to do the smaller, time-consuming jobs that keep you from your best thinking. When we coach people, we make recommendations for actions that we know will change their prosperity. But sometimes they hesitate. They say they have no time. They don't know where to fit transformation into a life that is so busy. Sam says, "I haven't mowed my lawn for probably 7 years now. I actually do own a lawnmower, so I don't look like, you know, too much of a person who's above that. But I think I've used it twice, and each time I've said, 'This is crazy.'" Sam says he's keeping things around the house like lawnmowers and tools as props for his kids, so they don't get the wrong idea. He doesn't want them to give interviews later in life and say, "We never saw a lawnmower around the house." Sam says, "Eventually I'm going to have to get an empty briefcase and dress up in a suit and leave the house once in a while, just so they're not living in this bizarre fantasy world." We're not saying never do anything with your hands. In fact, some people get great satisfaction and relaxation from yard work. It's a full Zen retreat for them on weekends to work in the yard. But they are doing it mindfully, joyfully, for that very reason. Not because it's a part of their stressful life of things that need to get done. One CEO we were coaching was late for his meeting with 200 people because he was out buying office supplies for his company. Paper clips. He had gotten so involved in doing all these little things that he had lost his bearings. We gave him some daily inquiries to practice, such as, what are the things that if I did them would be high return actions? And what are the things that others could do that I could delegate? Are you yourself doing a lot of $10 an hour tasks, yet you could be having communications that yield 20, 200, or 2,000 times more return than $10? And that's the whole point. Always do the math. Always keep your eye on the big picture and don't get sucked into the quicksand of stressful, needy tasks. The great health guru, Andrew Weil, says he just loves washing dishes. He always volunteers to do the dishes at gatherings. One might think, wait, he's the rich and famous Andrew Weil. He doesn't have to wash dishes. But it's loving it that draws him to it. Loving it. People create wealth in their lives when they love what they're doing, not when they need to do what they're doing. When Napoleon Hill said, think and grow rich, he was really asking people to elevate their consciousness. Stop feeling stressed and start thinking, what would I love to do? He was saying think in the same way that IBM used to say think. In the early days of IBM, they used to have the word think all over the walls in their buildings. And what they really meant was, get out of this non-thinking, low consciousness, habitual busy work that people hide out in. Focus on doing what gets you what you want. Number 19. Be a complaint department. Thomas Edison said, quote, restlessness and discontent are the first necessities of progress, end quote. One of the ways we've seen small businesses and individuals turn around to prosperity is in their relationship to complaints. When people